You are Locked On Cavaliers, your daily Cleveland Cavaliers podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Joining me now for a two-parter, first of two parts, is Jake Chapman from 93.3. Jake, what's going on, man?
Hey, Chris, how are you, bud?
I'm doing good. So we're just going to dive right into this. Jake and I are going to answer a bunch of questions, discuss a bunch of questions we both have about the Cavs. Jake, I want to start here, though. Brown season is starting up as we record this, preseason action. The Indians got our good friend Yasa Puig. They got Framil Reyes. They're really good. They look to be very fun, have climbed all the way back in that division race. The Cavs are gonna, I think, pretty clearly be the, in terms of quality of play, be the worst of those three teams. So my first question just about this upcoming Cavs season, where do they fit to you within the Cleveland sports landscape? Because there's these Len Komorowski quotes that he told Crane's Cleveland, like he actually thinks the other teams, specifically the Browns, would be good helps the Cavs. I don't know if I buy that. I don't know if I buy trickle-down fandom, but what do you just make of where the Cavs are going to be fitting in as we think about this really good Indians team and this very exciting Browns team?
Yeah, I don't know about the trickle-down fandom part either. But I don't know. I'm always interested to see the way this develops because we have like all these sort of, you know, like I guess agreed upon ideas that there's only so much expendable income in the city of Cleveland and that, you know, we're only able to support like 2.5 teams or whatever. And I just never necessarily bought that. Like, I think, yes, obviously right now the Cavs are third in the pecking order. And the other part of that, Chris, is like, you know, you mentioned Puig, you know, between Lindor and Puig, like now there's some real star power for the Indians as well. And as we know, the Browns have like a ridiculous amount of star power. So even casual fans, I think, are going to be drawn to those two teams first. And we know obviously how much, how dominant Browns fandom is in the city. But like, I don't know, during the winter, there's not a ton of things to do, right? Like I think the Cavs are still going to see okay attendance numbers, whether or not it's still residual effect in the end season ticket holders from the LeBron years. Like, I don't think it's going to be, you know, a barren wasteland this year. People still like going to the game, and part of that is just the fan experience. So yeah, they're going to be third on everybody's mind. And like, as far as 92.3, the fan, you know, we're going to try to carve out some space for Cavs talk in the next couple months, but obviously the Browns are going to be exactly where everybody is and what everybody's thinking about. But I also don't think, you know, the Cavs are just going to get completely forgotten. Like, they still have a whole lot of goodwill and interest built up from the LeBron years. And again, I think people go to the arena because that's what people do during the winter time.
Yeah, it's cold. And look, I've been, you've obviously, I think, been downtown. I've been downtown a couple times recently. As much as I don't love how the city got that new looking Rocket Mortgage Field House, which I'm just going to call Gund Arena in my head forever. That's my own headcanon. It looks really nice. Like, it does look really nice, and from what I know what the plans are, it's probably going to be a really cool place to watch basketball games in.
Yeah, and for as much as we, you know, sort of wring our hands about Dan Gilbert and his involvement with the basketball operation, like, you can't deny that it's a good experience, and a lot of that is because they dump money into it, and yes, like, we could get into the you know, the political landscape as far as the addition and the renovation goes, but people are going to go down there to check that out. Like, that usually draws a wave of tickets sold. And anytime you make drastic changes to a building, people want to see what it looks like and get that experience. And who knows, like, they do still have some star power. I mean, Kevin Love is still a member of the team, and there's young players that I think people are interested in, and there's a young head, or, you know, not young, but a new head coach that people are going to be a little interested in. So I think there are reasons to go watch the Cavs, and like I said, like, I don't think people are just going to say, like, they suck, I'm not going. I mean, Cleveland is a better sports town than that, put it that way.
Yeah, Cleveland's, I think the Browns are just clearly, like, the focal point. You can see that via, like, any kind of metric you want to pick. Like, the Browns are sort of that pulse. But, like, I think there is an argument to me that the Cavs, just based on where we're at right now, are the number two popular team in the city. I don't know if I personally believe that it's there, but I think that's where this is headed based on just the trajectory of the different sports, although I love going to Progressive Field. It's like my that is my favorite fan experience in Cleveland, is going to the game, like getting a beer, eating food, just enjoying like that relaxation. That is my personal favorite right now, just because it's just there's nothing like just relaxing and watching a baseball game. There's no like there's no other experience that is quite like that. Jake, I'm going to turn this to you. What is just a question you have? Like, what is something you, when you think about this upcoming season, where what is just a question you have about this team that you kind of want to get into here?
Yeah, I think it's just the kids. Like, I want to see if Sexton takes another step. I want to see what Garland is, what Porter is specifically. I mean, those two guys are kind of the key to, I guess, the timeline. Like, if you feel like you really have something with Garland, then, you know, you can sort of shorten up and say, we want to make the playoffs in two seasons or something like that. And Porter, I have absolutely no idea what to expect. Like, I expect Garland to be somewhere between how Colin was towards the end of last year and maybe a little bit better right off the rip. And that might be high expectations, but I, you know, anytime you spend that high a pick on a player, like you're expecting him to at least flash early on in his career. Porter, I have no idea. So if Porter looks like, wow, they might really have something here and there might actually be some star potential, I think that's like a huge, you know, sort of key early on this year and early on in this rebuild is, you know, did you hit on that lottery ticket with Kevin Porter Jr.? And then the other thing that I'm really anxious to see is Beilein and the offense and whether or not he's able to sort of, you know, make tweaks to make it more NBA friendly. You know, we know at least sort of loosely what the two guard offense looked like in the Big Ten and in college basketball. Well, it's a different game. So are you going to utilize Kevin Love running elbow stuff? Are you going to make it maybe a little bit more pick and roll heavy and simplify some things and run some more ISO stuff that, that coaches tend to do in the NBA? Like you find something that works and you run that. So I think it's, I love the idea of having a more movement-based, free-flow type of offense, but it might take some tweaks and it might take some growing pains to utilize it, especially with young players.
So here's my big question. Let's start with Garland, and we'll get a bunch of, you know, other – we'll get into Porter Jr. because I have a question just about him in particular specifically. But Garland is really interesting because I have – like, we're recording this on August 10th. You're listening to this, let's say, like, in the week after August 10th, right? I have absolutely no idea, and I don't think anyone except the people in the Cavs really have an idea of how they're going to deploy him. We also, I mean, I think one of the, I keep a running list of questions, and I want to make sure I get answered on media day, whether I ask them or someone else does. Like, I just want to know how many knee surgeries he had. Like, I just feel like, yeah. Like, I just would like to know. We knew about the one when I talked to his high school coach, who is still in contact with him the night of the draft. That coach was like, yeah, he's healthy. He's good to go. That we know they're precautionary with him. And then David Griffin, of all people, is the one who sort of, like, is the guy to put that out there, that he had, like, a knee surgery at some point in the draft process that I don't think we knew about. And then Chris Fedor had that as well. I just, like, want to know what their plan is for him. Like, is he going to be brought along slowly due to health concerns? Is he going to start right away with Sexton? Do they bring him off the bench first and then, like, maybe and bring him in kind of like they do with Sexton last year and then start him at some point? I just, like, want to know that. And I just want to know what Beilein's process is on that as well and how that matches up with ownership in the front office. My preferred, I think, scenario for that is for him just to start. I think if it's not him, you know, I would rather... Put it this way, I would rather not have to, like, have him and Jordan Clarkson be, like, a guy, a duo coming off the bench. I don't think that's going to help Darius a ton. So I would rather maybe just start him, and then if it's... I'd rather the weirdness come with the guys you're going to build upon than, like, the guy who, like, might not be in the team come the deadline, if that makes sense. But I just feel like there's just, like, a lot about how Garland is going to be used from the start and then as he progresses that we just don't know yet. And then I think there's just questions around, like, his health and stuff that need to be answered as well.
Yeah, that's obviously, I mean, the knee is a big concern, and it's something that you need clarity. I would think, I mean, I don't know, like, you can't speculate, but I would think they're, like, pretty comfortable that he's, you know, going to be ready to go right off the rip. And, I mean, you nailed it. I think by the end of this year, they have to have an idea whether or not Sexton and Garland can play in the same backcourt together. I think
well, I don't know if you need to know at the end of this year. I don't know if we'll know. Like, I don't know. I think we'll have an idea, but I just, like... Yeah.
How about this? How about they need to know if it's not going to work? You know?
Oh, yeah. I think that's
if it's a complete mess, But you're right. I mean, Chris, I think that's a great point, is we get so carried away with, like, you know, making final judgments on players within the first 2 or 3 years of their career, especially with guards and ball dominant guys. Like, they get better every year. I think you and I have talked before about, you know, the Lowrys and Dragics of the world who, you know, it takes until they're 27, 28 years old before it all sort of clicks into place at times, especially with point guards. So that's a good point. I think, like, I think you have to know what direction it's headed. Like, and I think we're going to find out early in the year if they view Sexton as a six man type, or if the idea was to actually draft Garland and Sexton and play them together, and that's going to be your backcourt of the future. Because as we know, like, you have to have some questions answered. Like, are they ever going to be able to defend if it's the two of them playing together as your one and two? You know, which one is probably best suited to play off ball? Like, I don't know the answer to that. So I think, yeah, like I want to know what it looks like with the two of them in the same backcourt together. And you're right, like the Jordan Clarksons of the world, you know, sort of throw a wrench in those plans. And it's going to be tough to balance early on in the year, like trying to showcase guys, the veterans for potential deals, and then just trying to develop and have those guys on the floor together and see what the future looks like.
Yeah, and I think, too, with these guys, we got to remember that, like, when you look at Lillard and McCollum, this was because of some injuries and some other stuff, but, like, they didn't know what they had in those two. Like, they didn't play together full-time until year three, and that was, like, the only year that that was McCollum's first, like, real NBA year. That's really weird, and that's not ideal, but, like, that can happen. And I do think the roster just being, like, sort of what it is. Like, there were five guards that reasonably, like, and kind of point guardy types that, like, reasonably probably should get minutes. And that's weird, you know? Like, there's just, like one of, I think one of Delly and Brandon Knight just, like, can't play. Right? And I think, like, if they're going to do this correctly, that's, like, a very tough conversation to have for guys that probably not only just want to maybe, like, in the case of Brandon Knight, like, are, like, an interesting trade piece and, like, could, like, be a team to talk themselves into, but, like, also, like, guys that want to get paid again next summer when there's going to be, like, a lot of money out there and, like, they're coming off these big numbers that they're probably not going to match again. Like, Delly's not going to get, like, 9.7 ever again, but...
Like, no way.
That'd be wild. But, like, they need to, like, prove that they want a contract. Like, if Matthew Dellavedova is, again, let's say, like, which I think is not an unfair thing to maybe think, like, if he's going to be on the Cavs going forward, like, it's got to be, like, he's got to do something that shows he fits with those guys this year as, like, kind of, like, the third guard and, like, sort of the veteran defensive typey piece.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't see that happening. You know, I think no matter what, Dellavedova is a pretty proven known commodity. But Brandon Knight, maybe not. I mean, a healthy Brandon Knight could still absolutely help a veteran team and could help this team and help the development of those guys. Like, I kind of like the idea of having Brandon Knight around, especially if you're able to turn him into any sort of an asset, and having him on the floor as well. Like, I think there's some value there. Delly is probably going to be the odd man out, I would think, all things considered. But you know, like, I don't know. You make plans and God laughs. Like, last year was such, I mean, nobody could anticipate the way the first 2 or 3 months of last year went, as far as the injuries and as far as the roster went for the Cavs. So it is. It just feels like kind of a slap together roster right now. But that's what happens when you rebuild, I guess. And it's going to be interesting to see Beeline, especially because, you know, it's not like an assistant NBA head coach who just sort of stepped up and it's his first, you know, opportunity. Like, Beeline is a veteran, old type grizzled guy who you assume will be a little bit more comfortable with the veteran players. And, you know, he's going to appreciate being able to coach and talk to veteran type guys. But he's a college coach. So, you know, you also would expect him to have that sort of teacher mentality and ability to relate to the younger guys. So it's a weird situation, like, watching the way he's going to, I think, sort of vacillate between having veterans on the floor and trying to make sure he's instilling the system that he wants and building good habits, but also letting the young guys sort of bump their heads along the way.
All right, let's go to a kind of tangentially related topic. You mentioned Kevin Porter Jr. I just, like, want to know what, like, my big question for him is I just want to see how much he plays, right? Like, I get the feeling that, like, nothing is really off the table with him. I think it's very clear, based on his college tape, based on just the development of his game, based on kind of where he was drafted and whatnot. Like, while the Cavs may think very highly of him, I think it's pretty clear that they don't... I think it's pretty clear that he's the most raw guy coming into the league. Dylan Windler, like, I don't want to, like, say, like, because he's a four-year guy, like, he's ready to go. Like, he's going to have adjustments. But, like, Kevin Porter Jr. is still pretty raw at all this. Did not have, like, a great, successful season. Like, he at least played more games than Garland, but I wouldn't say his freshman year at USC was, like, the most, like, eye-popping year a prospect could have had. I don't think that's the case, for sure. But I just feel like you could have anything for him where, like, we see him maybe get some G League time in versus, like, he's playing a lot of minutes right away. And I feel like the middle ground is kind of the key for him, because I don't know if you want to throw him to the deep end right away. I think that's why, like, Windler, I think, should probably get some minutes ahead of him to start, just because you know he's going to come in and spot up. That's why I really like getting Sindarius Thornwell to be a wing body. I think being patient with Kevin Porter Jr. is the way to go with him. I just don't know what that looks like. Like, I don't think... Like, I do not necessarily, I don't necessarily think that it's a must, but I do not necessarily think that time in Canton with the charge is the worst thing in the world for him either.
No, I mean, he feels like a guy, like you said, like, all over the map. I have no idea what to expect right away. I don't expect him to be, you know, particularly refined right away. You know, I mean, there's a lot of raw skill here, but it's very, very raw, and there's, you know, there's a sort of element where it feels like, you know, he might be, I don't know the best way to put it. It's almost as if he's mimicking the dominant NBA players, like, right? Like, he's got hardened moves, but they were barely working in the Pac-12, right? So you're going to have to harness all of that. And there's flashes there, you know, like you said, you watch the tape and you see how it can all fit together. But I don't expect it to fit together right away. Like, they're going to have to bring him along slowly and actually have a plan for him. And like you said, like, some time in Canton would probably be ideal there. Then you get back to, can he handle that? Pretty clearly, he sort of bucked back at the plan they had for him at USC, and the whole thing seems like it was a mess. So I'm not sure that it's the best thing to look into. But hopefully he has, you know, he comes in with the mentality that, like, you know, I got something to prove. I'm going to put my head down. I'm going to trust their plan for me, and I'm going to take those baby steps, because there's certainly – you've seen the flashes there, and that's a lottery ticket. Like, if at the end of this year you feel like he's at least on the right track and they have a good plan for him and he's in the right place, then absolutely, that's a big boost moving forward.
I'm very fascinated with him, too, just because, like, he is the type of, like, prospect. I'm going to look this up as we're doing this, just to make sure, like, I'm going to correctly cite, like, where he was ranked coming out of high school. But, so, this is a guy that, coming out of high school, he was the Mr. Washington, Mr. Basketball 2018, which makes me feel very old, considering, like, it's, like, almost a decade after I graduated high school, because I'm old now, and that's how this works. He was as high as 16 in recruiter rankings. His composite is, like, ranking is, like, probably, like, it's, like, 40 in ESPN and 27th on another one, and then 16th in Rivals. So there's, like, some fluctuation there. Rated as a five-star prospect. Like, that's an elite prospect. That is not the type of guy that John Beilein was getting at Michigan, right? Like, his success stories are guys like Caris LeVert, who were coming in after almost going to OU and then being a last minute offer and going to Michigan. You had guys like Nick Stauskas, who blossomed under him. Guys like Iggy Brzezikas and guys that are, like, good prospects but not elite prospects. How does a guy that is this talented, has this frame, has these skills, even if there's some refinement you need, and you know, you wonder what if his shot gets adjusted and stuff like that, and how, if he's going to be able to defend, but that, like, has elite athleticism, already has some really, really silky moves, and it looks like he's going to be able to just at the very least get buckets in the NBA in some degree. How does a guy like that when Beilein gets to help that guy grow, help that guy thrive in his system, what is the result? And I want to see that. I don't know what that means for it, if you need to get minutes right away or what that looks like, but I want to see what John Beilein does with a guy like Kevin Porter Jr., who is that talented, who has this much raw potential. It's the same way with Garland, too. I think he comes in a little more just sort of like the package is just a bit more developed just because of just where he was drafted in. I think the pedigree is probably just a bit up there, but I'm very fascinated to see what he does with a guy like Kevin Porter Jr. to just bring the best out of him, and if he can do that in the NBA, and with a guy that is just, I mean, frankly, just much more talented than some of the guys he coached in Michigan.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, how does it work with proven veteran players as well? Like, you know, some of these guys are finished products, I guess is the best way to put it. Like Kevin Love is what Kevin Love is, and he's still a very good player. So now it's on John Beilein to, you know, not develop him and not get him to the next level, but to utilize him properly and put him in the best situations, you know, at this level. And that's different than, you know, having 3 or 4 years with a guy and getting him from 2 stars to 4 stars, and getting him to buy into a team concept and buy into a system that works and that sort of day-to-day market improvement. Like, yes, he has to execute that with Porter and with Garland and with Colin and with Jetty to a certain extent, maybe even Larry Nance with the young guys that you expect to be a part of it moving forward. Certainly with guys like Windler, you know, Dean Wade, if you want to throw him in there, whatever, but you know, how does that play? How does Beilein's plan of attack and the way he approaches day to day work with Jordan Clarkson or work with Kevin Love? Like, I think there's some questions there as well, and those are fair ones. Like, Beilein is a guy who, you know, I think you and I talked about it when they first hired him. Like, you get enamored when you listen to him, and he just seems like he's got that sort of teaching mentality. But this is different. It's, you know, the NBA is such a different environment. You know, these are grown men who are making 10 times as much money as you are. So at what point does he have to sort of alter his approach just as far as teaching and person to person, you know, communication goes? I could see that being something that takes a little while. Like, it's, you know, that's going to be, and I think it's great that he has, you know, some help, guys like J.B. Bickerstaff. Like, I think that's going to ease that transition, but I'm anxious to see sort of the way that works just as far as just person-to-person stuff goes.
All right, we'll wrap up this is going to be a two-parter with Jake, but Jake, give me one last question for part one here.
One last question for part one. Well, we covered the kids. I think, you know, the trade value aspect of all of this is really interesting when you're just going through the veterans. We talked about Brandon Knight a little bit. Clarkson, I think, is fascinating. Like, what do they do with Clarkson to strike that balance between, like, showcasing him and maybe even figuring out if he's a guy that they would want to be interested in re-signing? Like,
I just want to say that the piece that came out that was like, wow, what if the Jordan Clarkson could be a piece on a contender? Like, I'm not going to say where that was from. I don't want to, like, just talk a bunch of shit here, but I'm not doing the Jordan Clarkson is like, when you drafted Darius Garland and are like, okay, our last two first round picks were two guards that are offensive minded that, like, we already, like, are going to need the ball, like, come on. Like, let's not do this.
Right?
Yeah, he's got to play this year, and, like, you got to trade him. But, like, if they get, like, an extension for him would be, like,
we would riot. I mean,
I have just, like, no idea. Like, there's one reason that piece gets, like, done and it's framed in that way. That's all I'm going to say. Let's continue.
But you know what? I mean, Chris, it's a good, like, look, he did better last year as far as not just being a complete black hole and coming off it every once in a while. But
Jordan Clarkson,
right,
like, as a cutter and a catch and shoot guy, I'm in. Count me in. I think he's super skilled. Like, he's got a lot of skill.
But aren't you nervous? I mean, we're just saying the same thing. I'm nervous about him on the floor with my young prize possession guards. Like, hey, as I say now, I do, right? Like, I don't want them learning from him and watching him in, you know, maybe in small doses. Every once in a while, you got to have that killer mentality, but, like, I don't think that's a problem with Colin or Darius. So, yeah, like, I want Jordan Clarkson has the ability to, you know, to negatively impact the development of your young players, but they got to be careful with them. That's all I'll say.
No, I agree. And I'm going to just pull this. I'm trying to find this right now so I can tell you, like, what their two-man lineup data is. But, like, I think he's, like, I'm going to say this about Jordan Clarkson. He really grew on me last year because when he, like, doesn't get a chance to just go in ISO and, like, he gets a chance to move off cuts, to spot up, to, like, come off a screen or, like, make one or two dribbles, he's, like, a really skilled offensive player. Like, the dude is, like, legitimately skilled at scoring the basketball. It's just he has to do it in a very particular way where, like, that right. is maybe not, like, it is probably definitely not worth the money he's getting. It is not worth, like, just some of the amount of, like, featuring he gets. But if you get him in a situation, like, Like, I think the best case scenario for the Cavs in terms of getting finding a home for him is, like, you want a team like them that's, like, really needs to just try something, and you get something in value in return for it. Just want to point this out. Last year, this is from Basketball Reference, the Jordan Clarkson and Colin Sexton, this was Colin Sexton's third most common lineup thing. It was so he number one by a wide margin was Osman and Sexton. Number two was Nance and Sexton. Number three was Clarkson and Sexton at 1,138 minutes and 46 seconds. In terms of a net per 100 possessions, it was a negative 11 per 100 possessions.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
It's not great. Neither of them defend. Yeah. Neither of them are like. Particularly Clarkson just like doesn't really try on defense very much. Like him once saying that like if he could have anyone's skill, it would be Kawhi Leonard's defense is like one of the funniest things any player has ever said. Like that's just an incredible flex by my guy Jordan Clarkson. But like him, I just like think if you're going to play him, it's got to just be in a situation where it's like you're just trying to find like the moments where like he's not going to really negatively impact these guys. That's a really tough thing for John Beilein to manage, I think.
Yeah, and with Beilein, like how short is that fuse? You know, like he's going to test his patience immediately, I would think. But with that said, like I said, like I think he did a better job last year. He wasn't as infuriating as he was the year before, like in the postseason. I wanted to kick him off the team during the postseason the year before. Yeah. But last year, I think he settled in a little bit, and I do think he developed a little bit. So I think there is some value there, like showcase him a little bit, and then come January, someone's going to be looking at him as a nice bench spark, and maybe you can move him and get something.
I think that's what you're hoping. I think you're hoping a team that is like trying to win in what feels like a wide open NBA is going to come and get Jordan Clarkson. But we're going to be back tomorrow with another, or later this week. I don't know how exactly I'm releasing these just yet, but you can find Jake on Twitter at JakeChapman923. Jake, thank you so much for coming on for this part one of our kind of deep dive into a bunch of these questions.
You got it.